Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
What made you want to get into journalism in the first place?
So my dad was a journalist. He was a staff writer for The New Scientist back in the 1960s. And then by the time I was born, he sort of specialised in sort of technology. It was quite a niche, it was sort of like technology and retailing, which sounds very dull, but he was publishing his own newsletter and research reports. This was back in the 1970s when a newsletter meant you actually had to print it all out and staple it together and put it in the envelopes and post it and all that. So he was a working journalist. My older sister ended up going into much the same kind of thing, and there was just always news on all around the house all the time. My dad would be the kind of person who'd watch the 9 o'clock news and then watch the 10 o'clock news as well straight afterwards. And he got the papers in every day, so I was always surrounded by news. And I was just always fascinated by current affairs. And I was going to show him I was going to go in and do real news rather than all this technology and supermarkets kind of stuff that he specialised in. So yeah, that's kind of where it came from, really.
And then a bit about your background career before you actually started Bristol 24/7.
Okay, sure. So when I came out of university, I got some work experience at The Independent in London. So I went down there and I was there. I was supposed to be just there for a month, but ended up getting a job at the end of it. So I was a junior assistant on the news desk, answering the phones and sorting the fax machine out and sorting the post out when it came and doing little bits and pieces, really. I was sort of like involved in sort of like the forward planning diary, and I'd help journalists out with a bit of research here and there. This was like 1998. So the older ones would come to me and ask me if I could use this newfangled internet thing, which they were quite sure about and all that, you know. So I'd do some work with them on that. Moved on to education features at The Independent. So it was kind of like editing sort of education magazines and supplements and all that. But I really wanted to get into news. So I came back to the West Country where I was from, and I ended up joining the Western Daily Press, where I was a production journalist there, and became, by the time I left in 2009, I was the deputy chief sub-editor there. So I was designing the front pages and making all the news pages look nice, that sort of thing, making sure they were all accurate and spelt properly and stuff. But around about 2005, I could see where the future was going. I could see it was all going online and all that sort. And then by 2007, when the iPhone was invented, I could see everybody was going to be using their phones for everything. So I kind of got very quickly into the idea of getting into online and digital journalism. And I'd come up with the idea for Bristol 24/7 as an independent news website that I could build myself, just off a WordPress background. Back in 2005, I first thought about doing it, and then I finally plucked up the courage to do it in 2009. So I launched it then, having been planning it for sort of a good year or two before that. And then so I started doing Bristol 24/7, did that full time, just sort of top level story. I'm sort of left in 2014, and after that I was with the BBC working as a broadcast and senior broadcast journalist there in Oxford, and then back in Bristol working on digital work. Went back to The Independent again for a while, doing the night editing of the digital edition up in London there, which was quite fun to go back sort of 20 years later after they'd become online only, the first newspaper to go online only. And amongst all of this, I was doing a bit of teaching at UWE as well. So one thing led to another, and I ended up teaching you. That's kind of it.
Nice. Sounds busy, busy, busy career.
Yeah, it was a bit. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So what made you start Bristol 24/7 in the first place? Like, talk me through your thought processes and just like why you thought it was something that Bristol needed.
Okay, so around about 2005, when I started seeing this was where the future was going, It was around end of October, early November, so just coming up to Guy Fawkes Night and all that. And I wanted to know where there was some good fireworks displays going on in the city. So, of course, I went online and sort of started having a look, did a search on fireworks displays in Bristol. There was nothing really that I could actually find easily to actually answer what seemed to be a very, very basic question. And I thought, well, why isn't there? I could do something like that. And it kind of sparked from that, you know, because it was just a lack of really basic information online that people could access to find out how to live life in Bristol. So I started thinking about that. So I could set my own newspaper up, that sort of thing, and not having the first idea of how to do it. But fortunately, my sister and brother-in-law, they started getting into this a little while ago. My brother-in-law especially had become quite an expert on building websites using WordPress, which was a lot more basic than it is now, the version that you use. But I could see, you know, he showed me very quickly, you know, you could take 5 minutes to set a website up and it cost you next to nothing. And this was getting into the days when people would be developing themes to make your website look really nice and all that, you know. So it seemed very obvious to me very early on that actually, yeah, you know, you don't need a huge budget and a team of thousands and offices and all that sort of thing. You can create a newspaper, an online newspaper from home. So I started thinking of it like that, really. It was those two things, really. Sort of like, where do I find out about the fireworks? And then finding out that it was just very, very simple to build a website. And so if you combine that need, that perceived need, and combine that with, wow, it's really easy to do as well and very cheap, then that's really where it all sparked off from there. I didn't go into it straight away, but by around about 2007, 2008, I was kind of decided, yeah, I've got to do this at some point, you know, and the theme development had come on quite a lot from then. WordPress had developed quite a lot from then. So I could see I could actually build something that I like, you know, that looked good and looked professional as well, because I didn't want to just write a blog. You know, I wanted to make something that looked sort of like a proper professional newspaper, because I was a professional journalist and I wanted to produce something professional. So I started researching that, and then I started thinking about, well, how do I make this pay for myself? You know, I want this to actually be my job and all that, you know. So I started trying to sort of look into, and I've never done any kind of business research or anything like that, you know. So I was looking into how that could work. I kind of got to the point where I knew I could build something, and I'd done a business plan up and all that sort of thing, but the business plan kind of changed quite abruptly, because I had a bit of a light bulb moment in terms of, you know, everybody at the time thought that, well, you know, if you're going to do a news publication, well, you've got to sell advertising, haven't you? That's how it's always been done. But around about this time, social media was starting to really come to the fore. Facebook had been invented and was growing in popularity. Twitter had just been invented. That was growing in popularity as well. And I could see lots of people were using it. And I kind of put two and two together and thought, well, you know, there's this vast array of small businesses. You haven't got the finances to spend thousands on adverts in the Bristol Post and all, but the Bristol Post has a declining readership as well, but they all want their own websites and they all want to get on Twitter. And how do I use Facebook to get in touch with my customers? And that's, you know, that's where the audience was. So instead of thinking of 24/7 just being led by advertising, I thought, well, far more sustainable to actually turn it into kind of like a digital marketing agency. So I kind of like positioned it as something so I could approach small businesses, charities, that sort of thing, you know. So, you know, I can build you a really low cost, good looking website. I can show you how to make the most of Twitter and Facebook. And a lot of it was all self-taught, but it seemed quite obvious, and with a bit of research seemed, I could do it. And I was doing it all for 24/7 as well, you know, so like promoting the brand. So I was kind of practicing on 24/7 and putting all the, what I was learning into that kind of thing as well. So, yeah, and so that the added value was, well, you know, if I do a website and some social media, unlike these digital marketing companies, you'll also get some free advertising on 24/7 as well and get put in front of all the people who are reading my news stories. So kind of, that kind of the development of the technology and sort of like having that light bulb moment with the business plan and all that, you know, sort of. And also by the time it came to about 2009, I was still working at the Western Daily Press, and we were right in the midst of the financial crisis then, and the paper decided to have another huge redundancy round, which would basically leave the Western Daily Press with sort of like one man and his dog working for it, after having, when I joined in 2002, there was like 50, 60 full-time journalists working for it. After this round of redundancies, there'd be like five people sort of working for it full-time, and it was really just sort of like an aggregator stealing all the stories from all the local newspaper groups around the region. So all the stars kind of aligned, and 2009, I volunteered for redundancy. I had all the plans ready for 24/7. I'd started building it already. And within a couple of months of taking my redundancy payment, I was there, and it went live on June the 29th, 2009.
I bet that date is like ingrained into your brain.
I will never forget that. Yes. So there was quite a few that were starting up around the time, people having similar kind of ideas and all that, but there's only a few of them who survived because it was very difficult to make a living out of it. And most people were thinking, in those old ways of, I'll get some advertising, that sort of thing, and that will make you pay, because that's what, you know, how journalism had funded itself for 100 years, and so everybody just assumed it would be the same thing, but it wasn't. And it was very difficult, especially for journalists, to go out and try and be full-time advertising salespeople, you know, when actually most businesses didn't want to spend thousands on advertising. They wanted to make use of this newfangled thing called social media. They wanted better websites, that sort of thing.
Why did you feel it was important to start an online news source dedicated to Bristol specifically?
On a very practical kind of level, this is where I was living and working, so I knew the city, and I've been checking out quite a lot of the sort of like the online kind of debates that were going on, the bloggers around the city, and they were the ones who were really highlighting what was really going on. That was this was actually where some very good journalism was taking place, but it was being done by amateur bloggers and all that, you know. So I knew there was definitely a space there for an alternative opinion to what the Bristol Post was going. So this didn't lead into doing it, but very in the 6 months to a year after I started, the big story around was Bristol City wanted to build a new stadium and move out of Ashton Gate. Not far from there, at a place called Ashton Vale, which is only like sort of 3/4 of a mile away from where the stadium is at the moment. But it was greenfield land. And there was a local campaign group there that was very angry and very upset about that. But the Bristol Post was basically, we'll never know whether they did actually get paid by Bristol City Football Club to be their official PR campaign, but they certainly acted like they were the official PR campaign for the city. So day after day, it was article after article of like, isn't this new stadium going to be a wonderful thing to Bristol? We were also bidding for the World Cup at the time as well, and we wanted Bristol to be a host city for the World Cup there, and it was all, we'll get the new stadium and we'll get Brazil playing down in Ashton Vale and all that, you know. So it was, and there was virtually nothing said in the Bristol Post. Nothing reported on the campaign by local people around there, who were very upset about the fact that, you know, they were living where there was some green space right on their doorstep and all that. They didn't want a dirty great football stadium built on their green space, which was the only green space around for them. So not long after I started, this all kind of blew up, and I made a very calculated decision to sort of like very firmly not align myself with the anti-stadium, but to give them a really, you know, a strong voice as well and all that. And that helped to really build the reputation of the site very quickly, because people were actually able to see, and, you know, so like it was spread very quickly on social media as well, that, hey, there is actually a professional alternative out there that's actually reporting on something more than just, not just what the Bristol Post thinks is right for the city and all that, you know. So there was very much an appetite for an alternative provision there. I think any city that only has one newspaper needs an alternative opinion anyway. And because the technology was coming through whereby you didn't need £10 million to set up a new newspaper and thousands of staff to make it, print it, distribute it, sell it, that sort of thing. You know, so anybody in their front room could set this up. And literally that's what I did. I set it up. I had a laptop on my desk in my front room. And, you know, that's how 24/7 started. So there was an appetite for it. And the technology was there to deliver it, basically. And like I said, the business model there was changing as well with the financial crisis. People simply couldn't afford the huge amounts of money that the Post were charging for advertising in the paper. They didn't really get online as well, but that's where all the audience was migrating to in their thousands every month and all that, you know. So you could see that readership of the paper was falling off a cliff. You could see the audience online was growing, again bringing all those sort of stars together and all that. And yet, like I said, I was living there as well, so, you know, it helped that I wanted to make a living, and, you know, I knew the city quite well, so, you know, it suited me personally as well.
I know you said before that at the time there was quite a lot of startups that were going about, and a lot, like, not all of them necessarily took off the way that Bristol 24/7 did. Did you ever expect it to take off the way that it did? And did you imagine it being one of, I would say, the most popular news sites in Bristol and the South West?
Honestly, I really didn't know, but I spent a lot of time dreaming about how big it could become and all that. You know, I mean, that was, you know, I had dreams of thinking, you know, if it took off in Bristol, then I could, you know, could set up franchises in different cities and all that sort of thing, you know, so the 24/7 brand would be a sort of a national thing. And then, you know, then I'd get carried away and think, oh, I can't wait to go off to New York and set up New York 24/7, that sort of thing. You know, that I'd have definitely sort of left Bristol for that and done that. Did I actually think it would work out? I think I kind of believed in what I was doing. So I thought I was going down the right track. But I didn't have a defined sense of, right, by year three, I'm definitely going to be making this amount, and by year five, I'm definitely going to have this many readers or anything like that. So it was all a bit, I had confidence in what I was doing, but I really didn't know how long it was going to take or to what kind of level it was going to take. And so, like, the first year, I mean, I made next to nothing and ate through my redundancy payout. And it was only really about a year in when I was just treading water, just keeping my head above water and all that in the first year, or towards the end of the first year. And then kept going a bit. I managed to get a little part-time job working with Oxfam as well, which helped to pay the bills and all that sort of thing, sort of doing digital marketing for them. And then sort of like about 18 months in, managed to start getting sort of a couple of like really good website build jobs. And so that was, you know, that brought some good money in. And just sort of, yeah, just sort of start, things started taking about 18 months to a couple of years to take off and all that. I think that's what you need to do with any new business. You have to realize that for the first year or two, it's going to be hard. So it's always good to have some contingency funds to make sure you can still pay your rent and all that. But yeah, during that first year, I made very little, and I didn't really know sort of like when it was going to take off or anything like that. But I kept going. And it was a good job that I did, because it did start sort of like working out after about 18 months or so.
Was there like a particular like story or like a particular moment where you published something or something kind of got shared and that you were like, wow, like my dreams kind of started taking off and like, you know?
Well, there was the Ashton Vale Stadium one. So I remember being down at the planning meeting at City Hall when the planning application for the stadium was being debated, and I was there on the press row with sort of all the main sort of political journalists across radio, TV and print in the city down there. And we were all furiously tweeting away throughout the meeting and all that, and loads of people in the public gallery and lots of people following online. So that was kind of like, you felt like you were sort of like part of something bigger. And so that was all good. And then, yeah, seeing that people appreciated that I was giving an alternative point of view for that. There was also, I don't know if you were aware of the riots that took place nationally in the summer of 2011. Mm. So there was, you know, it all kicked off in Bristol as well. And I was in the middle of St. Paul's all the way through the night, sort of like reporting on that and taking photos and video and all that sort of thing, and writing stories sort of like when I got back home at like 2-3 in the morning, that sort of thing. And ended up getting interviewed on Radio 4 for the Today programme the next morning, and I was on Radio Bristol and all that sort of thing, you know. So again, that kind of stuff helped to put me on the map as well. But then as well as those individual stories in 2011, I won my first award. So I've got the Southwest News Website of the Year award in 2011. So that was a big feather in the cap and something that obviously I was like banging on about to anybody who'd listened for about 9 months afterwards. And then won it again the following year, but also I was also a runner-up in the National Online Media Awards. That was great because I went up to the Emirates Stadium up in London and was surrounded by all the major broadcasters and online players, you know, and I beat off sort of like the big, I beat off the BBC that night, you know, which was great. I loved that, you know. Yeah, so those couple of individual stories, but also sort of like winning those awards within sort of like 2-3 years as well, sort of like really helped to sort of cement the reputation of the site. And that helped, that, you know, that always helps, because obviously then it gives you better access to people for interviews, that sort of thing, because they know that you're a professional outlet and all that sort of thing, you know. And I know that's what I always feel sorry for the journalism students at UMI, because you're students, and too many people these days are too happy to just sort of like say, oh, you're a student, I've got time to do the interview and all that sort of thing. And we need to find a way of trying to persuade people that's not a very smart way of going about people, and that they ought to be taking their time out to actually speak to you properly and all that. But that was the way it was.
The winning those awards must have been fun.
It was, yes. I mean, yes. Very drunk at the end of
yeah. Yeah. Well, if you win awards for something you've created in your living room, there's no other way to celebrate, really, is there?
No, absolutely. Yeah. No, it was, yeah, and particularly with the second round of awards, I'd started working with a former colleague of mine at the Western Daily Press called Laura Williams, who was looking after all the sort of like the Ents and sort of like what's on kind of content on the site as well and all that, you know. And it was really good to share that with her as well, because she was doing it part-time and wasn't paying her very much or anything like that, but she wanted to get involved because she also thought this was where the future was going, and she wanted to be a part of it. So, you know, it was kind of, you know, it was good for her to be able to share in that as well, because she fully deserved it.
And so do you have much involvement now with Bristol 24/7?
No, don't have any involvement now. So there was, what should I tell you about that? So around about 2013, start of 2013, I was doing all right, but I was exhausted because, you know, it was still pretty much, I had enough volunteers and all that. Laura was helping me out, but it was still exhausting, and I was having to combine all the news journalism with trying to make money and all that sort of thing as well. So it was very, very hard work, and I realized if I was going to take it on to a sustainable kind of level, I needed some help. So I approached a guy called Dougal Templeton, who had been the owner of a magazine called Venue, which I don't know whether you've heard of Venue magazine, but it was basically the Bible of what's on in culture in Bristol and Bath since about the 1980s. Everybody bought Venue magazine across Bristol and Bath. You know, it was fantastic range of set of journalists writing for it. Great features, great reviews, all the what's on information and listings that you could possibly want. And it looked great as well. And it looked cool. And that closed down in, when did it close down? It was not long before I started up 24/7, actually. Anyway, he was running a publishing company based down at the Paintworks, doing sort of like commercial magazines and all that. But I approached him to see whether he would like to get involved in helping me take 24/7 up to another level and all that, you know. And combined with his experience and the fact that he always felt a bit guilty about selling out Venue and all that, you know, he wanted to get involved. And between him and me, we approached various people to get some funding for it. And cut a long story short, we relaunched 24/7 towards the end of 2014 as the website that you see today now, a monthly magazine. And we did actually have an app at the time as well when we launched, but that kind of died after about 3 months. It was a bit of a waste of money, the app, unfortunately. As part of that, we brought in a blogger called Martin Booth, who is now the editor of Bristol 24/7. And it was kind of like a sort of merger between 24/7 and the blog that he was running called Bristol Culture. Let's just say I had a bit of a disagreement after we started with Dougal and his close sort of partner, who was also working on the new 24/7 project as well, on sort of direction and roles within the new setup and all that sort of thing. So I basically walked away after about 3 months, actually, and left them to it. And Martin is now, you know, has been editor ever since and all that. I retain a shareholding, but that's as much contact as I have with 24/7 now.
How do you feel about the direction that it's gone in, like, since you left? Because obviously you said you had a disagreement.
I've still gotten involved. I mean, I own like some, not 1%, but like maybe 5% of it. So it's not mine anymore. But how do I feel about it? It's always difficult for me to talk about this, because if I say anything negative, then anybody will think, oh, well, he's just bitter because of like all the disagreements and all that sort of thing, you know. And I'm genuinely not bitter about it anymore, you know, because I was obviously upset about it at the time, you know, because I'd spent 5 years of my life sort of like working literally 24/7 on it. And then having got these people together to help me out and all that, you know, it all went very sour and all that. So yeah, I was upset about it at the time. But since then, you know, I've gone on to do great things at the BBC and gone back to the Independent. And now, you know, I really love my job at UWE and all that, you know. So it's actually all worked out for the best. So I'm not bitter at all. What do I think of 24/7 at the moment? I'm still amazed it's still going. So there's that pride there that it's still there. The what's on content is difficult because we tried to do sort of like dedicate, you know, full comprehensive listings of everything that's going on in the city and all that. But doing listings is an impossible job. It takes forever, and you need a few people working on it all the time, because if you think about the size of a city of Bristol and all the things that are going on, imagine trying to type up each one. You know, it's a very, very difficult job, you know. So since the pandemic as well has struck, they've had to lose quite a lot of their freelance staff. So their what's on coverage is nowhere near as comprehensive as I think we would have ever liked it to be. I mean, they're doing well in terms of bringing sort of like the community reporter scheme through. I like that. We've got one of our former graduates, Charlie Watts, is doing lots of stuff down in Knowle West. That's great because Noel West never gets covered by anybody apart from, you know, unless it's a crime story or something like that, you know. So that's really good because when I started my version of 24/7, I wanted it to be a really powerful alternative voice for the city. But I'm very happy to stand back and watch it all from afar now.
Finally, what advice would you give to people who are wanting to start up their own news websites or like news businesses or even just like any sort of career in journalism? What would you say to someone?
Well, I'm going to break it down. A career in journalism and how to set up your own website is that's a vast range of stuff and all that. So if you wanted to set your own thing up, so you have to do your research a lot. I think that there's a number of ways that you can publish yourself now. So it's not just through starting a website, for example. You know, you can just be a social media person, you know, so you can use social media platforms just for storytelling. You know, you're reaching a particular kind of audience through that. So if you understand and really hone your skills in that kind of content, then you can actually, you know, you can actually do quite well and you can sort of build up a reputation and think opportunities can work from there. I mean, you've seen sort of like, you know, so you've seen the YouTube stars over the years and all that, you know, that, you know, there are many who make a very good living out that kind of thing. There are new things coming through like Substack. You know, you could be a newsletter writer. And if you really get that right, then you can do well with that. But I think, so there are a number of different options for you. So you need to, understand what you want to achieve. You need to understand the audiences behind each of these platforms. You need to be very sharp in understanding who the audience is that you want to target and the kind of content that audience would like to see. So it's no good now. I mean, I was thinking about it when I started up 24/7. I understood that I had a particular audience out there in Bristol that was very keen on finding an alternative view on what was happening in the city. And so I built the website very much for that kind of audience. Quite a lot of the time, I'd stray from that audience. But I think you need to be very sharp and you need to be very focused all the time on who your audience is, understanding what they want, and then honing your skills so that you're delivering the best quality content possible in the right way for that particular platform that will have the maximum impact on your particular audience. If you want to, and then in terms of how to make money out of that sort of thing, then, you know, it's again, if you're providing an audience with exactly the kind of content that you're after, then you've got a chance that they're going to pay for that. And you've got far more chance of people paying for content now than you did 10 years ago when I was doing 24/7. So that's a good thing. But if you want to make enough money to live on and, you know, have a comfortable life and all that sort of thing, then that has to influence who your audience might be. You might need to widen your audience out. You might need to rethink the kind of content that you're going to do, that sort of thing, you know. So you have to understand that there is a big balancing act between there are a lot of platforms available for you. There's a lot of different types of content that you can create. And there are lots of different types of audiences out there that need a particular combination of platform and content. So you could, for example, produce really fantastic niche content on a particular type of platform, and you will engage a small audience who might, you know, who'd be very quite willing to pay for your content, but it might not be very much. It might only make sort of like a few grand or something like that in a year or something like that, which is obviously not enough to live on. But if you want to make 40 grand a year, then you're going to have to think of delivering much more types of content across different platforms and to reach different types of audiences who are still willing to pay for that kind of content. So it's very complicated. It is very complicated, but if you do your research and if you gained the advice and experience of people who have gone through it, who are still working in that kind of industry, who are doing similar kind of things that you would like to do, then you're giving yourself every chance to succeed. In terms of getting a career in journalism, there's plenty of opportunities. There's lots of jobs going now. They're not just reporter jobs. They are SEO editors. They're social media reporters. One of the graduates I saw yesterday who finished the BA last year, she'd taken a bit of time to work out what she wants to do. She's just been taken on by Reach, based in Bristol, who do the Bristol Post and all those websites. So she's now a social media reporter, which is great, fantastic. You know, these are the kind of new digital journalism jobs that are around, you know, and they're coming through all the time, and there are plenty of opportunities. So when you come through next year, having hopefully done newsroom practice with me and all that sort of thing in level 3 and all that, you know, you should have a good range of core skills. That means you can go into it, look at Gorkana and look at the journalism jobs that are coming through and say, oh, well, sort of SEO coordinator. Well, these kind of jobs now sit within the heart of newsrooms, both old traditional and new and all that, you know, and they're absolutely nailed on for you. So there's lots of opportunities. And even, you know, even at the traditional outlets, BBC Bristol are crying out for digital freelancers at the moment to work on the digital desk. So there are plenty of opportunities there. It's a good time to be getting into the industry.